Good morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
So good to be back here. Thank you for coming back. As you know, we've been following Jesus on the tumultuous emotional journey of the final weeks of Jesus' life, from the time that he leaves Galilee and goes down to Jerusalem. And we've been doing that because we are looking, at least I'm looking, you too, I think, looking for some lessons, for something that can help us as we face disappointment, sorrow at the loss of an ideal, the crushing of a hope. Social psychologists tell us that people are suffering from melancholy. Some people call it utopian melancholy. So the melancholy that arises when your dreams are lost, when you feel betrayed. And that's where we're turning today. Today we are going to the final conversation that Jesus has with his disciples. After the Lord's Supper, they are still sitting at the table. This is Luke chapter 22, verse 21. Just after Jesus has given the disciples the bread and the cup, the very next verse, he says, "But behold, but look, the hand of the one who betrays me is with me at the table." Almost every word of this verse is revealing and evocative. The Greek verb for betray is the verb paradidomi. Can you say that with me? Paradidomi. It means literally, Pastor Bossy, it means to hand over.
Yeah, of course.
It means to deliver to the authorities. To put a person's life in someone else's hands. That's what's going on here. Now notice that when Jesus tells this to the disciples, the name of the betrayer is what? Omitted. Now we know who he is. Who is he?
Judas.
But Jesus doesn't mention his name. Is that concern for Judas? Or does it suggest perhaps that he is only the worst betrayer? That other disciples may have doubts? Now notice that Jesus says the hand of the betrayer is what? With me. That little phrase in Greek emphasizes the relationship that the betrayer has with Jesus. Yes?
Maybe Jesus doesn't know, but knows that there is a betrayer among the group.
Someone. That's a good point. That's possible. Luke does not depict Jesus as having supernatural foreknowledge. Nowhere in Luke's account do you get that. So you could be right about that. Maybe Jesus knows that there is a betrayer, but doesn't know the name. Yes?
But does Judas really think he's a betrayer?
Good question. Does he think that he is a betrayer? Or does he think that Jesus is on the wrong track? A few years ago, manuscript hunters discovered a Gospel of Judas. You remember that? And in that Gospel, he is not a bad guy. Now, wouldn't it be interesting to be able to interrogate Judas, to have a heart-to-heart conversation with him? What did you have in mind? Now, maybe you have felt at some point personally betrayed or betrayed by a friend. When I was trying to finish my degree in Chicago, I applied for a job at McCormick Theological Seminary, from where the school from which Pastor Bossie has his doctoral degree. And it was a job teaching the Greek language, right? I started off as a language teacher. It was a part-time job. It wasn't permanent. At the end of the year, McCormick announced a full-time faculty position in New Testament, my field. Well, I was young and deep in debt with student loans, trying to start a family with that beautiful redhead back there. And when I discovered that one of my own classmates at Vanderbilt, with whom I shared the quest for knowledge, with whom I'd spent many hours translating ancient text, he applied for my job. And he was so much better qualified. He had all the educational advantages. He had been to Oxford and to Göttingen and to Yale. I felt betrayed. But the language in Luke's text here emphasizes the painful, personal relationship. The hand of the betrayer is what? With me at the table. Yes, please.
How would the story have come out if Jesus was not crucified?
Wow. Can I thank you for asking that question? Because in about 30 minutes, when we go to the Garden of Gethsemane, we're going to find out from close reading of the text, Gary, that, see, now I'm projecting myself onto you. We're going to find out that Jesus himself was engaged in an inner struggle. And he's sleeping at night where? We found out, the Mount of Olives. All you have to do to escape from the temple police is simply to walk over the other side of the Mount of Olives. It would have been just that easy. Does anyone remember a novel by Nikos Karantzakis called what? The Last Temptation of Christ. You remember that? They made a movie out of it. It was very controversial. And the premise of that movie is that Jesus does what? Walks away. Goes back to Galilee. Has children with whom? Mary Magdalene. Grows to be an old man. Plays with his grandchildren. I'm sure he could have rationalized that, right? So your good question brings us already in front of maybe the most important issue that we have to deal with this morning. Why didn't he just walk away?
He had free will, just like us.
Yes, that's the way Luke represents it. It's a struggle of the will. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays, Father, if you what? Will. And then he repeats it. Your will, not mine. It's almost as if Jesus isn't sure that God has heard him. Right? It's a question of will, of choice. Oh, these are such insightful comments. Now I want to make one more point about this verse that we've been looking at, the first one. Luke says that the hand of the betrayer is with Jesus where? At the table. Epites trapezas. Now, what did we learn a couple of weeks last week about the locus, the special place of the kingdom of God? For Jesus, the table. Where Jesus had fellowship with whom? Anybody and everyone, including tax collectors and sinners. The table was for Jesus, as New Testament scholar John Dominic Crossan once said, Jesus' table fellowship was the kingdom of God in miniature. And we discovered last week that when Jesus wanted to hand over the project of the kingdom of God to his disciples, knowing that he wouldn't live to finish it, he did what? He created a ritual meal. This, he took bread and broke it and said what? This is my body. The cup, and said, this is my blood. So this is the point I'm trying to make. Don't you think it is extremely poignant and painful that at the very place, precisely the place where Jesus had invested all of his hopes and dreams, right there, he encounters whom? The betrayer.
But he must have been trusting because they gave the money to Jesus.
They did. They did. Judas was the treasurer of the group. Now, thank you, Joyce, for that. And that brings to my mind an experience of betrayal that happened on a national scale. When I first arrived in Australia as an honorary professor of ancient history, the Anglican Church was in crisis and in grief. Have you all heard about this? The treasurer of the Anglican Church embezzled the entire pension fund. He was never caught. I don't know if he went to the islands or to Switzerland. He escaped. When I arrived there, there was in the Anglican Church a deep sense of what?
Betrayal.
Betrayal. I think that lies at the root of a lot of the melancholy that people feel here in our country today. You know, people who worked hard at middle class jobs all their lives, they did a good job of raising their children, and then what? The jobs vanished. NCR left the city that gave it birth and went where?
Atlanta,
and the head of the whole thing in New York, of course, along with the billionaires. I don't know how you felt about it. I felt it was a monumental betrayal of the Miami Valley, the Dayton area. When Diane and I visited Stockholm for an ombudsman meeting, and someone on the tour of the Stockholm Museum proudly showed us an antique, very early NCR cash register. They thought we would be thrilled. I couldn't bear to look at it. Sense of betrayal. I think a lot of other people now are feeling betrayed. They feel like the democratic ideals, the hopes and dreams for a post-racial America, for an egalitarian society. But in fact, we're just becoming more unequal. The rise of white supremacy. Inequality is higher now than it has been since 1920. There's a new book you may want to read by Gabriel Zucman called The Triumph of Injustice, Stanford professor, in which he demonstrates with a detailed database that it is the changes that have been made to the tax system that have created inequality on a scale that we've never seen before. So I think this sense of betrayal is very much at the bottom of the melancholy that we're feeling. And let me remind you of how dangerous it is. A historical example. When the armistice was signed between France, Allied powers, and Germany at the end of the Great War, the First World War, students of German history, people of German heritage, will know that the German political leaders agreed to pay what? Reparations. A huge burden of reparations. It resulted eventually in the crash of the German economy,
The Deutsche Mark was worth almost nothing. People came to the bank with wheelbarrows. And a deep sense of being betrayed by their political readers infused the whole German population. And guess who built upon that? Adolf Hitler. That's what he built upon. That sense of betrayal. It's very dangerous. And now watch what happens. The next verse. Jesus says, the Son of Man, talking about himself, goes according to the way that has been determined. We saw at the beginning of our work together that Jesus himself found a place of inner resolve. Even though he knew that John the Baptist had been beheaded. You remember that? So he says, the Son of Man is going to keep on going along the way that has been determined. But, ouai! It's a word of lament in Greek. Woe! It's not a curse. It's a lamentation. Ouai! To the one, to the person by whom I am betrayed. The Son of Man is betrayed. Let me make clear what I think is going on here. Jesus persists in the way that he is going. His resolve remains firm and unshaken, even in the face of betrayal. He knows where the road is going to lead him. In other words, the betrayal by Judas does not prevent Jesus from carrying out his calling, his mission. But there's something else here. Even though Jesus feels and knows that he has been betrayed, there is no hint that he tries to prevent Judas from doing what he has planned. And furthermore, listen to this, in our own political moment, there is no hint of retribution. Some leaders, when they feel like they've been betrayed, they do what? They retaliate. They frog march them out of the company. No hint of retribution here. Yes.
But in the plan he had to have a betrayal in order to be given to the authorities for that crucifixion.
This
had he not been betrayed, that may not have happened.
This is such a deep, deep paradox. I'm sure that you've puzzled over it too, right? Mm-hmm. What is the function of Judas within the economy of salvation? Right? Those of us who feel that Jesus suffered for us, that his death and resurrection makes our lives meaningful. Do we owe Judas?
No.
Anything? You see, I agree with you, but the paradox is a profound one. And the best commentary that I read in getting ready to talk to you all today by a wonderful Harvard professor who died of cancer a couple of years ago, Francois Bovon. When he reaches this point, like you, he says, it would take the dialectical sophistication of a Karl Barth to understand this paradox, right? The paradox of Jesus' saving destiny and Jesus' willingness, I suppose you could say God's willingness, to tolerate what? The betrayer. I agree with you. It is a deep, deep paradox.
Larry?
Yes.
Thing, just as a footnote or comment on your observation would be that in my mind, Judas was not the only one who was there.
Thank you.
Who would have played the role that Judas did. The authorities were after Jesus.
Yes.
He was upsetting, creating turmoil. He had to be arrested. He had to be put away.
Right. I agree with you. They would have gotten him without Judas.
Yeah.
They would have gotten
him. And
by a close reading of the text in just a minute, we're going to see that a fight breaks out among the disciples, the people that are there for the Lord's Supper. And I'll show you a verb in a minute that indicates that some of them found that, you know, could it be me? Could it be me that he's talking about? Laurie?
Well, I was just thinking back to Judas. Could he have even been giving him another chance to choose between money and what is right?
Thank you. See, I think that is the possibility that is signaled here by this word of lament. Right? Jesus doesn't try to stop Judas. He doesn't exact retribution. He doesn't even name him. But what does he do? He weeps over Judas. Woe. It's a word of lamentation. And maybe Jesus was hoping that if Judas saw how much sorrow this was causing him, that he would have second thoughts. Next verse. Here's the verse that I wanted to show you. And they, that is the disciples, began to argue among themselves who of them might be about to do this. Now, Gary, the reason that I think that something is going on here is that the verb that Luke uses is the verb suzetain. Can you tell? Say that with me? Suzetain. That's the one that I've translated here, argue. But if you do the word study, it actually means to contend with one another with persistence for a certain point of view, to dispute, to debate, to argue. You see what I mean? They're not just having a friendly discussion. Oh, who could this be? They are contending with one another, holding out for a certain point of view. I think it's him over there. Because maybe you feel like you have, in some way, held back or betrayed. I think it's certainly suggested by the verb. A sense of having, a broader sense of betrayal among the disciples. Next verse, chapter 22, verse 24. But there was also a dispute among them about which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. It's not just the betrayer here who is breaking Jesus' heart and disappointing him. They haven't learned what?
Anything.
And the noun that is used here for dispute, Gary, is the noun philonekia. You see the word in here? Philo means what?
Love.
And nikeia?
Victory.
Victory, exactly. See, aren't you glad you have reassurance I'm not making this up? In other words, the disciples are engaged in a political competition, like these people out in Nevada now, right? Fighting with one another. They're engaged in a battle with a competition with one another. Philonikeia is the desire to win. They haven't learned anything. And that moment must have broken Jesus' heart along with the betrayer who put his hand there with Jesus on the table. Next verse. And Jesus said to them, listen, the kings of the nations lord it over them, and those who have authority over them call themselves benefactors. In other words, here Jesus begins an explicit contrast between the power politics of our world and the politics of the kingdom of God. And he uses explicit and overt political language. The kings of the earth, this is
Basileus. And this is not just used for little local kings, it's also the title in Greek of the emperor in the Greek of this period. He is the Basileus. And Jesus says these people, they lord it over, curiouein. They lord it over their subjects. A few years after Jesus made this observation about the power politics of his world, Tiberius, the adopted son of Augustus, was smothered with a pillow by his little nephew named Caligula, a monster. Caligula was emperor for only 3.5 years before he was assassinated. But one revealing thing that Caligula said, according to the historian Suetonius, he said, "No one until me has ever understood what power the emperor has." Right? He's the epitome of what Jesus is talking about here. Diane and I watched on something that we get from Amazon Prime. Do you all get these things too? A movie last night called Conspiracy, because we like Kenneth Branagh as an actor. And it was about that terrible meeting that took place outside Berlin at the Wannsee, where the leaders of the Third Reich formulated the plan to do what? Exterminate all the Jews of Europe. And one thing that struck me is that they had trouble getting this conspiracy, this conference started, because as the leaders arrived, they spent all their time saying what? Heil Hitler. Worshipping the absolute power that lorded it over them. And as you got to know the characters at the table, you could see how frightened each man was of the Basileus, the ultimate power. Now that's what happens, right? And maybe it might be happening in our world too. We've got oligarchs now all around the world, dictators in one country after the next. But the next sentence is also interesting. Jesus says, "And those who have authority," and the word here is not power, it's not dunamis, it's a lesser word, exousia, authority. "Those who have authority over them call themselves," Gary, I take the word kalunta here to be a middle rather than an active or a passive. So it's not that they were called, but they call themselves what? Benefactors. Uergetai. In the ancient world, in the time of Jesus, as wealth concentrated itself in the hands of smaller and smaller groups, one of the ways in which the wealthy in the cities of the Mediterranean kept the population under control, kept down outbreaks of social strife, was by what? Bread and circuses. Benefactions. Now, they built monuments. They staged gladiatorial combats. They handed out bread, right? And that's not because they were just idealistic philanthropists. They call themselves uergetai. What does that mean?
It's a good worker. A worker of good.
Yes. A worker of good. And the Latin translation is benefactor. And we've got a lot of those around today. In New York, where I work when I'm not on sabbatical, we have a couple of brothers, the Koch brothers. Am I saying their word right? Koch brothers? And they've put their name on everything, even the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. These people exercise their authority by their benefaction, Jesus says. That's the way that the power politics of our world works. Now look at the next sentence. Jesus says, "But with you, it is not so. Instead, let the greatest among you become like the youngest,
And the one who governs, like the one who serves. Now, what's interesting to me here, Gary, about the first sentence in that verse, Jesus says, humeste hutos, there's no verb in there, in that sentence, but you, not thus. Now, is that a statement? Is it an indicative? Or is it what? An imperative. Is Jesus making here an observation? You're not a benefactor. You're not a king. If you want to really make a difference in the world, you have to realize that there is a different kind of politics. Or is Jesus telling them, among you it ought not to be that way. Among you, you ought to become like a little child and like one who serves. Or is the ambiguity here intentional? In any case, however that may be, what Jesus aims at here, he is suggesting that the human system of power and authority has to be subverted from the bottom to the top. It takes a complete turnover. The ruler has to become what? Like a young person. And the governor has to become like what? A servant.
Oh, Larry?
Yes.
You know, the manuscript D.
Yes.
Has instead mikrotiros.
Oh, that's very interesting.
The smallest.
The smallest. The least. Right? The smallest one. That's very interesting. That's an important manuscript because it's the primary witness to the Western form of the New Testament text. Now, the next question that Jesus asks the disciples in the text, this question is intended, it's somewhat playful, it's intended to tease out the assumptions that are operative with the disciples then and with us today about power, how power works. Jesus says, for who is greater? The one who reclines or lies at the table? Or the one who serves? And then he says, is it not a general consensus? The one who lies at the table, who is greater? See how he's teasing out the social assumption? When people went to a banquet in those days, the invited guest, those that were honored to join the host, they reclined at the table, and who brought the food in and set it in front of them, and the wine? Servants, slaves, household slaves. So Jesus teases out the assumption. You assume that the one who is reclining at the table is greater than the one who is serving. And now look how he turns everything upside down. In the next sentence he says, but I am in your midst as the one who serves. The inversion, right? The inversion of the dynamics of social power is stunning here. And it's something that I think each of us has to grapple with. Now, watch what happens in the next episode. I'm going to skip one paragraph because of our time. And I'm going to look at a conversation that Jesus has still at the table of the Last Supper with Simon Peter. Until this point, he's been talking to all the disciples, and now he says, chapter 22, verse 31, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has laid a claim upon you in order to sift you like grain. Now, notice here that Simon is addressed not by the name that Jesus gave him when he called him to be a disciple. What was that?
Peter.
The Aramaic form is Cephas.
But he's addressed by his old Semitic birth name, a name that his mother gave him when he was born. He's reminded, right, of the arc of his life, of who he was as a fisherman before he was called, the complexity of who we are. Simon, Simon. The fact that he repeats his name, what does that convey? Emotional feeling, right? Simon, Simon. It's a complex thing, this emotional repetition. It could indicate what? Affection, right? Oh, Diane, Diane, you're the best Valentine. But it could also indicate what? Rebuke, remonstrance. As when my mother used to say, Larry, Larry, why did you get into the closet and open your Christmas present before Christmas Day? Something I actually did. In other words, the repetition of the name conveys emotional force, but it's a complex mixed emotion. I think it's love, and it's love, and it's also rebuke, criticism. Now, Jesus says, Satan has laid a claim to you, and Satan is going to sift you like what? Grain. Now, this is so interesting. It shows how far I've wandered from my agricultural farm boy roots. The fact that I didn't know this until I was doing the research, the Greek verb here is syneazo. Can you say that with me? Syneazo. That's the verb that's translated to sift. It literally means to shake. And there is some violence implied if you look at the uses of this verb. But what was most revealing for me, and Gary, this is what an old historian does, I decided to go look at other places where that verb is used. And guess what I found? A Hellenistic Jewish text written just not long before the Gospels called The Wisdom of Jesus ben Sira, or Sirach. It's in the Apocrypha and Pseudepigrapha. Listen to this, chapter 27, verse 4. When a sieve is shaken, syneazo, when a sieve is shaken, the refuse remains in the sieve. And then Sirach says, so that a man's filth remains in his thoughts. Oh, now I understand what Jesus is telling Simon. Satan is going to what? Shake you up. And as a result of that shaking, the filth that is in you mixed with what? Good. I mean, after all, he is the one who put down his nets and followed Jesus. But the danger is that when Satan shakes you, what's going to be left? Filth. The good part will all fall out. That's the danger. And I think that's what you and I have to worry about now.
Filth will be on top of the social heap, too.
The filth will be on top of the social heap. Did you see the report this week? Big study done by, Johns Hopkins University, of instances of bullying and name-calling in grade school. Joyce, did you see that? How those have just gone off the chart in the last few years. When the shaking comes, what? The good drops out, and what is left? The filth. My wife told me when I had my eureka moment, right, with this verb, Gary, Diane told me, well, Larry, any woman who bakes knows that. When you put something in a sieve, that's what's going to happen. The good is winnowed out. It falls into the dish beneath. So Jesus is warning Simon about a trial in which the good that is in him might be defeated.
But Jesus is determined to block, to thwart Satan's efforts. And so the next verse says, Jesus says to Simon, "But I have asked for you, I have appealed for you, that your faith not fail." And the Greek verb here for fail is eklepo, which means to fall out, to disappear. "And you, once you have changed," epistrepho, which means what?
Turned
around. Once you have changed direction, once you have had an inner conversion, then you should strengthen your brothers and sisters. Now, I love this moment in the text. This verb, epistrepho, which Gary rightly translated as a turnaround. Do you know what this means for Simon and for us? It means that the life of faith, the life of fidelity and integrity that is in danger now because of the shaking, that life is not to be understood as a series of unbroken victories. It's not that the life of faith is without trial, without mistakes. The life of faith is a life of what? Turning around. Or, let me put it this way. The life of faith is a refound life. Oh, that's consoled me a lot. As I think about the mistakes that I've made, the opportunities that I missed, the things I didn't have the courage for, those moments when I hurt people deliberately in retaliation, those were all places where my faith was falling down, threatening to disappear. But that's all right. The life of faith is what? A refound life. The life of faith is a life of turning around, a continuing conversion. It's not just a one-time event.
That's the way you learn.
That's right. That's exactly right. And then after he is turned around, Simon is given a mission. He is told to strengthen his brothers and sisters. The Greek verb stairizo means to make firm, so that others can complete the course. And now the end of the paragraph. "And Peter said to him, 'Lord, I am ready to go with you even to prison and even to death.'" Listen to that boast of his own courage and fortitude. And look at how Jesus answers him. He says, "But Jesus said, 'I tell you, Peter, the cock will not have crowed today," this very day, the same day on which you're boasting, "until you have" what? "Denied me. Denied three times that you know me." Peter boasts about his courage, but soon all of his beautiful dreams are going to collapse. Very soon, that very day. Just a little piece of information here. Does anyone happen to know when was the time of night, the watch of the night, when the cock crowed? According to the ancients, Greeks and Romans, between midnight and 3 a.m. That's why we can't get the city of Dayton to let us raise chickens and roosters, because they wouldn't just be crowing when the sun comes up, they're crowing when? In the middle of the night. And that's when Jesus was put on trial. It was a illegal nocturnal session of the Sanhedrin. That's when Jesus was taken from one venue to another, and as he passed through the courtyard, he looked at Peter, and Peter looked at him, and at that moment, what? The cock began to crow. Before that, Peter had denied three times that he knew Jesus. Next verse, or I'm moving now down to verse 39 because of time. Then once outside, so now we have left the upper room of the Last Supper, once outside he, that is Jesus, went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and the disciples followed him. Now this little phrase, as was his custom, or his customary practice, I think it's very important, and it brings us back to the good question that you asked at the very beginning. Threats have been coming at Jesus. The high priest and the legal experts are conspiring how to arrest him. Judas is in the process of betraying Jesus. Peter is going to deny Jesus, but none of this diverts him from the way that he is going. None of it diverts him from his goal, his calling, his destiny. He went back out to the place where he had been sleeping every night. The very place where Judas knew to find him. In other words, this little phrase that he just continued on his way, as was his custom, by going to the same place, the Mount of Olives. This tells us clearly, and it brings us to your point, that Jesus made the decision not to flee. It would have been so easy. The other side of the Mount of Olives? It's another district. It's wilderness. It's easy to get lost out there. He could have just walked down the other side of the mountain. It would have been so easy. I think about myself, right? Is that what I would have done? Probably. Just walk away and go back to Galilee. The fantasy of Karen Zaki's novel. A full life lived with Mary Magdalene, children and grandchildren. But he didn't do that. He keeps on going. Chapter 22, verse 40. When he had come to this place, that is the Mount of Olives, he said to them, the disciples, pray that you not enter into temptation. So Jesus proposes that they spend the night in prayer. The Greek word for temptation here is an interesting word. It's the word peirosmos. Can you say that with me? Peirosmos. It has two meanings. First, it means test or trial. And then it means temptation. And I think Luke's choice of this word here, the ambiguity, the two meanings, it's deliberate. I mean, which one of us knows when an event is going to be a test that we can pass, a trial that we can overcome, or what? A temptation to which we give in or succumb. And it's because of that that Jesus tells the disciples to do what? Pray. Stay awake and pray. The next verse. And he, that is Jesus, went away from them about a stone's throw, knelt, and prayed. The Greek verb here that's translated went away is very poignant. So poignant. It's the Greek verb apospo. Thank you, Gary.
Apospo.
Thank you. Apospo. Thank you very much. Do you know what it means? It's not an ordinary word for going away. It means to pull away. And if you look at the way the word is used, it denotes a painful separation.
Opposite?
A painful separation. So Jesus experiences pain as he withdraws, as he separates from his disciples. And then the text says that he went how far? Hos lethu bole.
Larry?
Yes.
Could you go back?
Yes.
In the text, it's a passive.
Yes, that's
okay,
right.
In other words, he was dragged.
Exactly.
So now, what is dragging him?
Yeah, that's right. The verb is in the passive. It's hard to translate that into a good English sentence, but Gary's point is powerful. It's not like he's in complete control here.
He's having opposite emotions.
That's right, he's being pulled. He's being pulled toward the mission, toward the calling. But there's conflict here, and we're going to see it in a minute. There is inner conflict. There's conflict within Jesus, not just outside him. Now, this phrase about a stone's throw is very interesting. How far do you think that was? The exegetes puzzle over it. Of course, no one knows. It depends upon how strong your throwing arm is, I guess. It is possible, I think, that Luke, the author, means to suggest, and perhaps the tradition from which Luke is drawing, that because he was only a stone's throw away, the disciples could what? See and even more, Pastor Bossi, hear. They could see what he did. They could hear his prayer. I think that's possible. And then it says he knelt. Now, for 2,000 years now, Christians have been what? Kneeling in order to pray. But here's what you need to know. In the time of Jesus, Jewish worshipers did not kneel in order to pray. The synagogue prayer, when people went to the synagogue prayer is called the Amidah. Can you say that with me? Amidah. You know what it means literally? The prayer said while standing. You stand up to address God. So when Luke tells us that Jesus did something unusual, he knelt. What does that suggest?
Submission.
Joyce, I agree with you. You kneel before the sovereign, before the Lord. I think it might suggest some other things too. Can you think?
Humility.
Humility, I agree with you. And finally, I think it suggests the emotional struggle. He's not able to stand on his feet. He drops himself down to his knees. He prays kneeling. And here's what he says. Chapter 22, verse 42. Saying, Father, if you will, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. Notice that he addresses God how? Pater. Just as he taught us to do in what? The Lord's Prayer. But there's this poignant expression of the relationship that God has, that Jesus has with God. He speaks about God as Father. And then, most interesting is the cup. Father, if you will, take this cup away from me. The Greek word for cup is poterion. Can you say that with me? Poterion. And the use that Luke makes of it here is a well-known metaphor for death, for suffering, for destiny, and is especially, it turns out, in Jewish literature, where the idea is that the cup might contain a poison that is so deadly, or a wine that is so strong that it robs you of your ability to function, that it delivers you into the hands of the enemy. The most relevant parallel here is from a retelling of the history of Israel attributed wrongly to Philo. It's the Biblical Antiquities of Pseudo-Philo. And listen to this, chapter 50, verse 6. I drank the cup of of my tears. And just as you pointed out earlier, Joyce, the battle here is a battle of the will. Father, if you will, nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. Next verse, just a couple more. Then an angel appeared to him from heaven, strengthening him. Now, the angel who appears to Jesus here in the Olive Garden is not the angel of death, right? It's an angel like the one that appeared to Mary to tell her that she'd found favor. It's an angel like the one that appeared to the disciples on Easter Sunday. Notice that the angel does not speak, but the Greek says, using a present participle, that the angel was what? Strengthening him. And now comes the inner struggle. Chapter 22, verse 44. I would translate it, Gary. And in an inner struggle, the Greek word is agonia. And today, we think of agonia as what? Agony, right? Torment. But back then, in the first century, it doesn't have that meaning. It is a struggle. It's used, agonia is described of athletic. It's used of athletic contests.
Yeah, wrestling.
Wrestling. Exactly. That's what the agonia is. It's a wrestling match. And that gives us insight into what's happening here with Jesus. It says, and in an inner struggle he prayed even more intensely. And his sweat became as what? Clots of blood falling to the ground. Now, what's happening here? The angel has just appeared in the previous verse doing what? Strengthening Jesus. And yet, the agonia, the inner struggle, the wrestling match, as you quite rightly say, Gary, the wrestling match continues. The point, and this is a point for us to take home for our situation now, God's presence, even when we feel it. Sometimes I feel it. God's presence, even when we feel it, does not eliminate what? The inner struggle. It's not what you expect, what happens here. So what is described happening with Jesus here is not some sort of pain. It's not teeth gnashing or agony. It is an inner struggle of the will. But I should say something about the sweat. The Greek word is hidros. Can you say that with me? Hidros. The sweat like what?
Blood.
Clots or drops of blood. What's interesting here is that Aristotle, who was not only the expert on rhetoric and philosophy, he also wrote a history of animals, including the human animal. And in his history of animals, Aristotle describes a phenomenon called haematidrosis. I won't ask you to say that. Haematidrosis. The beginning of that word, haima, is the Greek word for what?
Blood.
And Aristotle says that under conditions of extreme inner conflict, the sweat can appear what? Suffused with blood. And there are examples of it in ancient literature. There's a Hellenistic Jewish text, a novel called Joseph and Asenath. And the heroine at one point becomes very anxious about the fate of her beloved. And the text says, and sweat poured out over Asenath's face with a red color. And now the end. And once he had gotten up from prayer, he went to the disciples and found them sleeping, and the text gives the reason why. He found them sleeping apolupes, from sorrow. They were right where we are, right? I'm sure they could sense that it's falling apart. One of them is a betrayer. Simon has been told, "You will deny me three times." The disciples themselves are searching their conscience. Could it be me? Could I have been unfaithful to Jesus and to my commitment? And so, you know, sometimes sleep can be a refuge from what?
Grief.
From melancholy. Good old depression sleep.
Good old.
Because it's a respite, right? For a few minutes you can let go of the depression and the melancholy. And Jesus says to them, "What? Are you sleeping? When you have gotten up, pray so that you will not come into temptation." Well, that's what the text gives us for today. To me, it's a lot. A lot. There have already been wonderful questions. The best ones we've had so far today. Are there other questions, comments?
Makes me think of some of the people who have faced things they knew was going to come out bad, but still did it. I thought of Martin Luther King, but I also thought recently something was over the Jewish uprising in the ghetto in Warsaw.
Yes, yes.
They knew that they were going to die,
right.
But they did it anyway.
Right. And, exactly.
That's been a huge, huge burden to face.
Right.
It's amazing people do that.
Other comments, questions? I'm losing the choir.
What's your thought? I'm trying to justify Judas, okay?
Yes.
30 pieces of gold or something, it's not worth it.
It's not worth it.
Okay.
Right.
Seems like he may have had some other motives where he would, maybe he was counting that when they go into Jerusalem,
yes,
Jesus will rise, he will have a sword, he will cause an uprising,
right.
We will be liberated.
Right.
Am I in the wrong boat?
No, I think you're going down the right track. New Testament scholars, and good ones, have suggested that. There's an old British scholar named S.G.F. Brandon who wrote a book called Jesus and the Zealots. Now, the Zealots believed that the people of Israel would be liberated from Roman rule. How? By an armed uprising. And Brandon suggests that Judas was what?
A zealot.
And therefore Jesus' decision to be a Messiah of peace. You remember he comes into Jerusalem acting out Zechariah's prophecy mounted on what?
A donkey.
And in that prophecy from Zechariah, it says that he will cut off the battle bow. He'll dismantle the war chariot. So perhaps Judas was outraged and disappointed, disillusioned with Jesus' decision not to fight. Yeah, I think you're on the right track. Yes.
A long time ago, I read an excellent historical novel by Taylor Caldwell.
Huh?
And she's written a number of books on Glorious Physician and Great Line of God, and then this one was I, Judas, and it just gave me a new insight into Judas, why we just keep harking on him rather than what was he after, really? He was not after the money, according to her.
Right,
he was
right.
More according to, he wanted this to change. He wanted things to change.
Thank you.
Really good. Taylor Caldwell. It's a very old,
Thank you. Thank you.
Great.
Very interesting.
Very good.
So many good comments today. I thank you all for all of them. For me, you could probably tell, the thing that hits me the most right where I am now is this reassurance that Jesus gives to Peter, that you may make mistakes, your faith may disappear for a while, it may fall. You may be tested and sifted, so that the good falls out of you and what's left is the bad. But keep turning around. Keep turning around.
Not the good side.
Yeah, keep turning around. Faith, the life of faith is a refound life.
Wasn't the Sanhedrin in a real uproar too at this point in time?
Oh yes. Tremendous conflict within the ruling elite. The ruling elite of Judaism
was
competing for power against one another by forming alliances with the Roman overlords. That doesn't sound like anything that's happening today, does it? Okay, for next week, our last week, I'm sad to say, you know where we're going. We're going to Calvary, to the cross. So if you want to get ready for it, it's tough.
You can't get ready.
The next week is the hardest of all. I'll see you next week.
Thank you.
Is there a... Yeah. These are such dresses.